Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we start a four-part series with historian Jill Lepore. Every week in the month of May, we're going to talk to Jill Lepore, American history professor at Harvard and staff writer at The New Yorker. She's worked with us to choose four moments of history that shed some light on how we got to the current moment in various ways. Today, in the first installment, we'll talk about the death of newspapers in 1765. Obviously, things are grim for many newspapers today. They're dropping like flies all over the country, and even the big ones are struggling to come up with a viable financial model for the future. Jill Lepore says the last time the American newspaper business got this gothic was 1765. She's here to explain that moment and how it relates to today. Jill Lepore, welcome back to WNYC, and thanks for doing the series with us. I think it's going to be great.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So what was happening in 1765 in the newspaper business?
Well, it's October of 1765, and there are about 20 newspapers being printed in the colonies at the time. All the newspapers are four pages long. They only come out once a week. It takes 16 hours to set the type of a newspaper, so the news cycle is 1 week long. And suddenly, most of those newspapers start killing themselves. The Maryland Gazette changes its masthead to read "The Maryland Gazette Expiring." The Boston Gazette turns its front page into a tombstone. And all across the colonies, newspapers profess that they are about to die, that they will all die together. They will commit suicide on November 1st, 1765. And the reason is that Parliament has levied the Stamp Act tax, and which is going to cost printers a very pretty penny, because there's going to be a tax on all newspapers, and there's an additional tax on any advertisements. And so newspapers very keenly understand they just really can't stay in business under the provisions of the Stamp Act. And in this kind of hilariously dramatic act of political theater, they collectively kill themselves. So that on November 1st, which is the day the Stamp Act is supposed to go into effect, there are funerals for liberty all over the colonies. And in Boston, this allegorical figure of liberty is being buried in a coffin, and an allegorical figure named Gazette jumps in after her and says, you know, "Unless thou revivest, I shall perish with thee. In our lives we were not divided, in our deaths we shall not be separated."
Wow. It also shows at least some of the American people's equation of the media with liberty at that time. I wonder if that would happen today.
The case that American democracy and the American newspaper grow up together. They really are born together. The word newspaper didn't even enter the English language until the 1660s, right when the British colonies are being founded. The first American newspaper is from 1690 in Boston. And the freedom of the press becomes a really pivotal, central political value to American colonists, you know, by the 1720s, 1730s. In New York, the Zenger trial, the famous trial of the New York Weekly Journal printer, John Peter Zenger, establishes the freedom of the press in 1735. And we, you know, the colonists have very strong views about the freedom of the press. And in a lot of ways, a lot of historians say it really is that Parliament's biggest mistake was to tax newspapers. It's not, you know, the Tea Act in 1773 that's the big problem. It's the fact that printers got so annoyed at Parliament, because printers controlled, you know, the political argument in the 18th century.
And by the time the American Revolution happened, there were 40 newspapers in the colonies. You wrote about all this in a 2009 article in The New Yorker, and obviously newspapers didn't die in 1765. So how were they saved, or was the death of liberty just an exaggerated position anyway?
Well, it was a very well argued exaggeration. There were all these sort of hilarious glimpses of newspapers, the ghosts of newspapers. Some newspapers that hadn't gone under, you know, would report they had seen the ghost of the Maryland Gazette out on the moors. And the Stamp Act, of course, was repealed because the colonial opposition to it was so strong and so effective, largely because it was waged in the pages of these newspapers, that the Stamp Act was repealed and newspapers went on to survive. That repeal was, of course, hugely important, but Parliament, you know, came back with other ways to impose new taxes on the colonies. Well, in 2009, when I was thinking, I got to thinking about this moment of political theater, because in 2009, 145 newspapers either stopped publishing or shut down their print editions. 600 newspaper employees were laid off a day that year. 40 newspaper reporters lost their jobs. Yeah, I mean, 600 employees laid off that year, but 40 people lost their jobs on an average every day, every working day of that year. So that wasn't a newspaper suicide year, 2009. It was the untimely demise of the American newspaper that year.
Funny enough, the opposite of the Stamp Act, I think newspapers and magazines were actually given a kind of stamp-related subsidy by the federal government in more recent times because they can mail to customers, to subscribers, at a preferential rate compared to other mail that heavy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a complicated relationship, of course, between news reporters and newspapers and the government. I mean, the point in the way the newspaper developed in the United States is that really is a kind of check on arbitrary rule. It was a check on the arbitrary rule of Parliament, and it later evolved over the course of the 19th century into a check into government power. So those subsidies are always complicated, right, because then we have kind of we're always in danger of moving towards a state-run media, and it's the possibility of a loyal opposition to the state that newspapers open up in the 18th century. That's one of these great innovations. But newspapers also run American politics in the 19th century. You know, in the 19th century, when you went to vote, you cut your ballot out of the newspaper in the morning before you went to the polls.
Wow.
The printers just printed, that's where you got your ballot. Newspapers were partisan, and there was your Democratic newspaper, and you'd get your Democratic ballot. So I don't think we've really wrestled with what it means that the newspaper has died in a kind of in an effective, real way. I mean, we are looking at a rebirth and new kinds of things, but what, you know, NewYorkTimes.com is not a newspaper in the sense that the New York Weekly Journal was a newspaper. It's a completely different kind of reporting and a completely different mechanism of delivery.
And maybe that's why there isn't the outrage today about the demise of newspapers, because, accurately or not, people feel very served by new media, or people feel surrounded by media, even if reporting itself is really endangered. But David Simon's fifth season of The Wire is maybe the equivalent of a funeral for liberty.
Well, I think that people feel that they now are the media. Right. There is no distinction between the reader and the writer. That's what this saturation of opinion has resulted in, right? Like, everybody blogs, everybody has an opinion, and I think what we're looking at is sort of the death of the newspaper editor. I mean, the demise of edited reporting, and that, I think, is something that we really do have to wrestle with. But everybody's willing to offer up an opinion.
Right. Although, you know, if you think that this is something new, if our listeners think that this is something new and that we should long for the good old days of neutral, staid, respectful, objective journalism, you wrote in the same article that, quote, early American newspapers tend to look like one long, uninterrupted invective, a ragged fleet of dung barges. You say that it was just plain malicious in many of the cases, but you also say it added up to a long and revolutionary argument against tyranny, against arbitrary authority, against, that is, the rule of men above law. Gosh, in a way, that sounds like our raucous internet today.
Well, I think there are people who would claim that. I mean, there are a lot of critics of that as well. I mean, Jefferson famously said newspapers should be divided into just four sections, and they should be titled Truths, Probabilities, Possibilities, and Lies. You know, when Charles Dickens came to the United States in 1842, he writes this sort of fictional scene of walking through the streets of New York with the newsboys calling out the names of the newspapers, and it's like, the New York Sewer, the New York Lie, New York Spy into your household. You know, people thought of American journalism as licentious, not embracing liberty, but, you know, sort of taking license with the truth. And there's a kind of hurly-burly all through, you know, the history of journalism. And I think you're right, that there is kind of nothing new in that regard. But pushing back against that at each stage has been a set of standards. People engaged in a conversation about how we discriminate between fact and opinion, how we make sure that, although there are many different opinions, that we hear all sides of them. That conversation has always been vital to our democracy, and I think we are in the middle of a period where we need to have it, I think, quite urgently, all over again.
So historically, given the hurly-burly, as you describe it, how do you think that and the vitriol in the press created any kind of coherent argument against tyranny?
I think what it allowed for was the idea that you could really disagree with your government and yet still be loyal to it. That is kind of the invention of the 1790s, right? After Washington comes to power and then Adams comes to power, and then Jefferson challenges Adams in the election of 1796 and loses, but in 1800 he challenges him and wins. And there's a point at which people think, how are we going to transfer power from the Federalists that Washington and Adams represent in the Jeffersonians, who have a very different view of government and who have opposed the Sedition Act, which the Adams administration has put into place, because Adams thinks it's not possible for people to actually criticize the government and still be loyal to the government. That's why Congress passes the Sedition Act in 1798. And Jefferson says, no, it's not only possible, it's necessary. That is how a republic must work. We must criticize the government. We must argue with one another. We therefore cannot ban speech that opposes the existing government. And that's the great triumph of the newspaper. So for all the scurrility and nastiness and malice, what that argument does establish is that you can say, I really disagree with this president, and I think his policies are bunk, and you can still be loyal. And that's the space that the newspaper conversation opens up.
Wow. Up next, we're going to be talking to Julian Assange's lawyer. Assange, of course, is the man behind WikiLeaks. And one of the main questions that people ask about Assange and WikiLeaks is it a publisher that deserves the rights and protections of journalists, like to protect their sources? Or is it something else? Is it an anti-U.S. organization bent on weakening the United States, especially in terms of foreign policy? But what you just said almost suggests that there isn't necessarily a distinction between the two, necessarily.
Well, I think that is a really complicated case and has to do, with international law and the boundaries between nations. And all those things are becoming much blurrier today, and I think that's what makes that so complicated.
And it's why they say that they set up WikiLeaks as a stateless organization.
Yeah, I think that, if one were Assange and attempting to justify oneself, there are antecedents that one could come up with. I'm not sure that I buy them, but I think you could certainly look to the past.
And in our last 30 seconds, do you think we're seeing the kinds of growing pains with the pro-democracy movement throughout the Arab world right now, movements which call for, among other things, a free press?
Yeah, I think, there's a huge amount of political disequilibrium caused by the new media. Not even moving to the Arab world, we can talk about that within our own political
social media, culture. Twitter, Facebook.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of disequilibrium. We had a kind of state of political equilibrium in some ways in terms of how we communicate and the boundaries of our arguments and the scope of our arguments. And that's kind of all fair game. It's a really important and I think quite urgent conversation.
Harvard history professor, staff writer at The New Yorker, Jill Lepore, will be joining us once a week all this month of May to talk about different pieces of American history that relate to what we're going through today. That was great. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.